Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
You're listening to Slice of Cheese with Jenny Linford on Food FM. Enhance your cheese board with Peter's Yard sourdough crackers this Christmas. Available at Waitrose, Sainsbury's, Morrison's, Ocado, Amazon, petersyard.com and specialist food retailers.
To find out more about Food FM and our content, go to foodfmradio.com.
Hello, welcome to A Slice of Cheese, the Food FM radio series that celebrates the world of cheese. I'm Jenny Linford, a food writer and cheese enthusiast, the author of Great British Cheeses. Cheese is a delicious and fascinating food, and we're setting out to explore this remarkable food and share the stories of the people who make, sell and love it. Episode 2, Geography of Cheese. A look at how cheese is shaped by the place in which it's made. Rupert Linton of Brindisa takes us on a journey to Spain. Alison Elliott of the Ham and Cheese Company shares insights on Italy's cheese landscape. And Andy Swinsky of the Courtyard Dairy talks about cheese and place in Britain, a subject close to his heart.
Online, on smart speakers and on Listen Again, this is Food FM.
Enhance your cheese board with Peter's Yard sourdough crackers this Christmas. Available at Waitrose, Sainsbury's, Morrison's, Ocado, Amazon, petersyard.com and specialist food retailers.
So this morning on A Slice of Cheese, very happy to have with me today Rupert Linton of Brindisa. Brindisa have imported Spanish food, high-end Spanish food, into Britain for decades now and done a huge amount to spread knowledge of Spanish food. And Rupert is their cheese specialist. Good morning, Rupert.
Good morning, Jenny.
Rupert, thank you for taking time to talk to us. This episode of A Slice of Cheese, well, I'm exploring a subject I think is rather fascinating, which is the idea of the geography of cheese, how the landscape of countries and places shapes the cheeses that are made there. And given your incredible knowledge of Spanish cheese and your enthusiasm for it, I thought it'd be wonderful for you to take us on a journey in a way through the Spanish cheese geography. And so, I mean, I thought perhaps we could start picture, perhaps set the scene in broad strokes, and then perhaps we'll hone in on some particular cheeses that have got, you know, a very fascinating relationship with the geography.
Well, I suppose if you think about Spain as and its geography, basically the geography determines which dairy animals will thrive in that particular ecosystem. So if you imagine like the northern strip of Spain that runs along the just south of the Bay of Biscay, it's a wet, you know, it's called Green Spain and has a very similar climate to say to Cornwall or somewhere like that. And so that part of Spain is where the majority of cows are and the majority of cows' milk cheeses. So
right.
The ecosystem there like determines that it's suitable for cows and those cheeses. If you when you go further south, like over the Picos de Europa mountains and head south into the plains in central Spain, that's the zone where most of the different sheep are, the different breeds of sheep, making the different like the classic, you know, the Manchegos, the Zamorano, the Castellano cheeses. And the Torta cheeses are also a sheep's milk cheese. As you approach the Mediterranean, again, the climate gets drier and rockier. It's more suitable for goat's milk cheese.
Brilliant. And so, what are some examples of those?
A cow's milk cheese from the north of Spain, like one of the really well-known ones would be Cabrales, which is made up in the mountains of Picos de Europa.
That's got a very... Let's unpick that a little bit more, because is that the cheese that is matured? You mentioned the mountains. Is that the cheese that's matured in the cave? Is that right?
It is, yes. So the Cabrales is... it's made in the dairy, And for the first couple of weeks, it's allowed to, it's inoculated by the Roqueforti bacteria, which just occur naturally in the air, in the environment of the Cabrales region.
Right. That's and interesting. So they don't put, you know, lots of people making blue cheese put that in, put that culture into the milk, but they don't need to then. It's around them.
Well, they don't need to. I mean, some there's quite a few dairies there, so some may add Roqueforti, but the ones that I visited, they use a natural method. Basically, they have the windows open and they just allow the air to flow through the cheese room.
until it goes blue.
Yeah. Once it starts to blue, then they move it into the caves. And so some dairies will have, like, they own their own caves or will have inherited their own caves. And other dairies use communal caves. So, like, every cheesemaker in the village there'll be like the village cave, and everybody gets assigned some shelving where they age the cheese. And one of the requirements, which I really love, one of the requirements for a Cabrales cheese cave is that it has a stream running through it.
Gosh, that's a very vivid thing, isn't it? What does that? So that's keeping what moisture in the air for the cheese, then?
Yes, it is. Yeah, I mean they're humid because it's a limestone landscape. So the whole area, it's got some of the deepest caves in Europe, and the whole area is kind of riddled with phenomenal caves.
That's interesting, isn't it? Because in Britain, our limestone caves are things like, you know, it's where smugglers kept things. But in Spain, they're keeping blue cheese.
In these ones, yes. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Although I'm sure the smugglers have been there in their time as well. Yes.
I'm sure. Oh, that's a very sort of evocative image. Have you visited some of the caves? Are you people allowed, you know, are you allowed to go and see the cheese?
Ah, yes. Yeah. No, I went to a communal cave in the village of Socres, and which was fascinating, really. When you go in, you have to wear a head torch because there's no electricity. Mm-hmm. And then they have, well, it's a cave. It's kind of slippery and wet. And then there's the wooden shelving just on either side as you go down through the crevices. With the cheeses, I mean, the ones that we're receiving at the moment are about 4 months old when they've left the cave. But for us, that's a little bit young. Normally, we're receiving them at about 6 months. So for a blue cheese, you know, that's quite a long time, I think.
It is. And
for the European blue cheeses.
Yes. And do you get a lot of bluing then because of this sort of long time in that atmosphere?
Yes. I mean, the bluing is kind of, it doesn't look like blue tack, but it is, you know, it's definitely blue. And but what happens as the cheese ages is that the texture gets creamier and creamier. And that's one of the aspects of the cheese that people really appreciate.
Yes, good. We've gone up the mountains. Take us to another part of Spain where there's a cheese that has a very close link to the landscape.
Well, one of the ones that I thought about was that there's a cheese from Andalusia, like, again, from a mountain range, but right at the other end of Spain, like right up, you know, on the Mediterranean coast. And there's a cheese there called payollo, which is made with the goat, the milk of the payollo goat.
Uh-huh.
And there they've almost got the opposite problem, because I thought it was quite interesting, because they've got, you could say, too much terroir going on. And so so this particular dairy, their milk comes from about 30 different, like, tiny herds of goats, and those goats are, those are the goat farms are located at different altitudes up the mountains. And so the cheesemaker has got no idea about what the goats have eaten that day, because they've all eaten they're all on different altitudes, they've all been in different ecosystems, had a different diet. And he was saying that he found it hard to make the same cheese twice, because the milk kept on tasting completely different. And so in the end, he pasteurizes. I mean, he's totally keen on raw milk and all that philosophy. He says if he doesn't pasteurise his milk, you can't make the same cheese twice.
Wow, that's so really interesting, isn't it? I mean, that's a real sense of the milk is, you know, that, you know, depending on what the livestock have eaten, that milk is going to be different. That's quite fascinating.
Yeah, because the thing is, because they're goats that are wild, they're pasturing out in the wilderness, so they're not goats which are raised in the barn where you can control their diet and and guarantee the quantity of the milk. These are goats that are out and about, kind of helping themselves.
Goats are famously independent, aren't they? As characters.
Very much so. Very much so. Yes. Yes.
It must be fascinating for your work, Rupert, because you visit Spain, so you must get such a feeling as you travel round when you look and see the landscape that you're driving through or travelling through, you must literally see these things that you're describing to us and the sense of how the place impacts on the cheese.
It's one of my kind of projects, in a way, is to walk in these environments. Mm. And a couple of years ago, I walked from south of France, from north to south, over the Pyrenees, and then in October, and then I arrived at the end of my walk in a cheese festival in a village where they have the Fira de San Irmengol. It's a small provincial town in the Catalan Pyrenees called La Seu d'Urgell, which is like has its kind of Romanesque cathedral.
Yeah,
but that walk over the mountains took me through the high mountain pastures where the cows feed, I just like the idea of walking in the landscape and understanding it in a kind of a really experiential way.
Yes, you're right. I mean, of course, walking is because then you see everything, you feel, you hear the birds and you see the plants and you feel the weather.
And the weather, and you walk through the herds of cattle as they kind of move up and down the mountain.
And that's interesting. So this sort of sense of these three different dairy animals in Spain, the goat, the sheep, the cow, have they coexisted for a long time, or these traditions of cheese making? Or I just wondered if some were more ancient. Was there a tradition of was it sort of goats or sheep came first, or are some cheeses older in Spanish history?
I think there's quite a lot of regional politics involved in that question.
That's a very tactful answer.
A lot of areas like to claim the oldest record of cheese making, and for some people it's like, we found these stone vessels from the Bronze Age that look like they could have been used for cheese making, and so people think that making cheese in Spain has been going on for a really long time. The book by there's a Roman author who wrote about agriculture called Columella. He describes cheese making and wrapping cheeses in fig leaves and that they were the cheeses were exported to Rome
The Romans, yes, they brought in all the good things from around their empire, didn't they? Quite sensibly. Yeah. And we should talk about the tradition of island cheeses too, because Spain, the mainland, is it? The islands have their cheeses as well.
Well, it's kind of like an answer to your question as well about the origins of the different varieties, whether it's of the species of animals that make cheese. And so, if you think about the Canary Islands, the original inhabitants of the Canary Islands were conquered in the Middle Ages by Spain, by the mainland, and the Spanish colonists brought their goats and their sheep with them and introduced them to the islands. But so over the years, because some of the islands have got quite a harsh climate, so not all of those goats and sheep would have survived. So over the years, there's been this process of natural selection of like new animals being imported into the Canaries, but only some of them surviving. Gradually, a rare breed has developed. There's a Canary Island sheep, a Canary Island goat, and there's a Fuerteventura goat or Majorero goat as well. As they adapt to their environment, they kind of develop into new rare breeds.
These rare breeds are used for cheese making. Their milk is used.
Yes, in the Canaries. The Canaries, because of the ecosystem, because basically it's a massive volcano, so it starts at sea level and then goes, where it's kind of dry and desert-like, and then it goes up to a couple of thousand metres, where at the top it's kind of misty and foresty. Mm. So with these different ecosystems, they're able to make a really wide range of cheeses.
Incredible.
And so with some of the really small dairies that still exist in Gran Canaria, they still move their flocks of sheep through the year. So they'll have a grazing area in the winter at sea level, just back from the beaches. And then in the spring, they'll take their herds halfway up the mountain to their village. And in the summer, they'll move the herds again higher up into the higher pastures.
To get, I was going to say, in quest of feed, pasturage for the goats, then for the animals.
Yeah. I mean, for this particular dairy, it's mostly sheep. So what's interesting for them is that throughout the year, also they'll make three different kinds of cheese. So in the wintertime, they'll make a cheese called Flor de Guía, which is a soft torta-style cheese made with thistle rennet. Mm-hmm. So you get those kind of like strong artichoke-y flavours
and
creamy
cheeses.
Textures. Yes. And then when the weather warms up, because to be able to make a torta depends on kind of cold temperatures and high humidity. And as the weather changes and it comes to spring, then they do what they call media flor, which is half flower, where they use half animal rennet and half thistle rennet. And that makes like a firm, like a semi-cured cheese. And then in the summer, they'll make their cheese only with animal rennet. And those cheeses will be matured for eating at Christmas.
That's brilliant, isn't it? So your sort of seasonality and place, linking so closely. Tell us about some of the other individual cheeses we've put up. Perhaps cheese that we wouldn't... I mean, I think lots of people have heard of Manchego. I think that probably is the sort of famous Spanish cheese that people have heard of. But it's such a rich cheese scene. Every time I've talked to you, I've been so struck by the range and variety.
Well, there's the Mahon cheese, which is one of my favourites. And I was thinking the Mahon is also quite an interesting example of terroir and of different dairies, because we buy our Mahon from an affineur in Menorca. And he gets his cheeses from about 10 to 15 different dairies. And so what he does as an affineur is he matches his customers to a particular dairy. So we receive our cheese from one dairy, but then he's got other customers. They like it stronger, or they like it creamier and younger. And so he matches. So even though Menorca's just one island, and you'd think the terroir would be, it would all be, the same everywhere.
Yes.
But with the different cheese-making techniques in each of these tiny farms, because these farms will make 10 or 20 cheeses a day.
Gosh.
And so they're really handmade, and then there's a difference from the dairy where it's located and how the each cheesemaker makes their particular cheese.
Wonderful. And what is the style that you like then? What's the cheese style you look for in the cheeses you get from this affineur?
Well we get quite a young cheese, really. Our ones arrive when they're 2 months old, 2.5 months old, so they're quite moist, I'd say, mm-hmm. and like full of like really fresh aromas. One of the peculiarities of Menorcan cheese is when you smell the rind, sometimes the rind smells of peaches.
That's lovely.
A kind of fruity aroma to it, because although it's not a washed rind cheese, it's got quite a lot of salt in it. I think that's just part of the traditional recipe for an island that never used refrigeration, or does now.
Used
refrigeration. So a lot of salt makes it last longer.
Sure.
But so you get those kind of like orangey blooms on the rind.
Yeah.
And then also they rub the rind in olive oil and paprika, which makes it even more orange. And then you get these interesting aromas developing.
That's so interesting. So even on this, when you sort of dig deep, it's this idea that it is a fascinating idea that when you eat a piece of cheese, that's made, let's say, on a farm, and and ripened there, and so many factors from that particular place have gone into making that cheese. It's so interesting, isn't it? In Spain, in the world of cheese making, is there pride in that sense of place? And I lived in Italy a long time, and so the originality is so important in Italy. Is that the same in Spain?
Very much so. I think in the last few years, really, the appreciation of artisan cheese in Spain is just flourishing. There's more festivals, there's cheese events, when I went to the Fiesta of Trujillo in May, which is an amazing cheese festival, there's like tens of thousands of people come along to taste the cheese. It's like it's absolutely heaving. And so yes, they're definitely. And what's interesting is in the Feria de Trujillo, which is in Extremadura, all the cheeses there are from that region.
Right.
But if you go to the Fira de San Ysmengol, which is in the Pyrenees, they don't have any Extremaduran cheeses at all. All their cheeses are from the Pyrenees. And only with one French dairy. All the rest of them were Spanish and Catalan, Basque cheesemakers.
So it's a real celebration of local cheese then. And
just the number of dairies is you know, there's enough dairies to fill a festival, basically. You know,
That's fantastic, isn't it? And thinking of cheese and place in a sort of slightly different way, and obviously Brindis, as I mentioned, have done so much to sort of introduce Spanish foods, I think, to, you know, because I've known about Brindis a long time, for decades. Are you seeing, Rupert, an interest in the UK, in UK customers, in Spain's rich sort of varied cheese tradition?
Yes, I do. Sometimes when I'm in the market in Borough, people who come to buy cheese, they're often really quite knowledgeable. Sometimes because they've gone on a walking holiday, or you know, they travelled across Spain. They went kind of overland through the middle, and they always have some kind of recollection of an amazing cheese they found in a village in an isolated region of Spain. So yes, people are interested. Yeah, and also with Borough Markets, I mean, it's not just British people. I mean,
of course,
I remember serving one customer from Alaska who was like desperately looking for Cabrales. Because it's very hard to locate in his part of the world.
Yes,
and so people come from far and wide for
that's a very good point, isn't it?
London Spanish cheeses.
Yeah, how wonderful. You know, London is so rich in that sense. It's such a sort of varied, and I always say, you know, for food shops, you know, and food shopping, shops and markets, obviously, thinking of Borough.
Yes.
You know, London has this richness to it, you know, which actually is well worth celebrating and exploring. So, Rupert, that was a wonderful, that sort of, I've been sitting at my desk, but I feel quite transported. So thank you.
Oh, good. That's thank you.
Been lovely. So, all right. Thank you very much, Rupert. Take care then. Bye-bye.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye then.
Online, on smart speakers, and on Listen Again. This is Food FM.
This week on A Slice of Cheese, very happy to have with me today Alison Elliott of the Ham and Cheese Company. Good morning, Alison.
Hello, Jenny. Nice to talk to you.
Yes, always nice to talk to you, Alison. I always learn so much. And Alison, you're the Ham and Cheese Company, as its name suggests. You import wonderful cheese and charcuterie from Italy and bring it back to London. Your work involves a lot of travelling. And for this episode of A Slice of Cheese, we're sort of exploring the idea of cheese and place, cheese and geography, the old geography of cheese. And I was really interested to get your insights into someone who, you know, who goes to Italy, travels around it, buys cheese. You must see, in a way, how place shapes the cheeses that are the Italian cheese landscape, in a way, I suppose.
We do, and we were in Italy last week in the south, travelling around Campania and Basilicata, and had a lovely time chatting to people there just about how traditions of cheese making have come about, how much they are linked, of course, to the geography, because like everything in Italy, it's also regional. Mm. And so, you know, it's so linked to the climate, to the animal, to the geography. And so we, at the start, we travelled into the wilderness of Basilicata, but actually we flew into Naples. And so we started off by visiting our mozzarella supplier. And that mozzarella is buffalo mozzarella is very much linked to the geography of that area, because those buffalo really found their home on the two river plains to the north and south of Naples. Buffalo arrived in, people think that they probably came to Sicily. They were brought to Sicily by the Moors in the 9th century. But then they, the first written reference to buffalo cheese comes from Campania. It's in the 16th century. So obviously they had made their way from Sicily further north. And then they found that the River Sele, which is that has a plain to the south of Naples. It's a big river plain. It was a big, wet, marshy plain. And that would have been perfect for these water buffalo, because they're big animals. They need fertile plains, and they need water. And then to the north of Naples, you have the plain of the River Volturno. So they lived happily there, and by the 18th century, cheeses made from buffalo milk from those buffaloes were very widespread around there.
It's a wonderful, rich milk, isn't it?
You're quite right. It's so different from cow's milk. It has that lovely, it's delicately savoury, slightly sour. It just has a more complex flavour. Mm. And it's the perfect cheese for, it's quite a big cheese. It uses quite a lot of milk to make these big balls of mozzarella. And it's perfect because down there, because it's hot, obviously, but it needs no refrigeration for quite a while. Buffalo mozzarella is always unusual. What we bring over, they put on the bags to keep it refrigerated because they know that we're going to be keeping it for longer. But actually, when you're in Campania, you're always told never put your mozzarella in the fridge because they're really particular about it. They will eat it all within 3 to 4 days, and the cold of a fridge will totally change the texture of the cheese and make it firmer. And so they will always eat it fresh and wonderful, not having been in the fridge.
So it keeps well enough just to be kept in ambient temperature. Wow, what a treat. Yeah. Good. Okay, you've made me hungry. Right, carry on.
I mean, it's interesting that Mussolini, he had those marshy plains around those rivers drained as part of, because they were malarial. And so they were drained in the late 1920s, but the animals stayed. And after the Second World War, production, it became more intensive. But now buffaloes can't thrive. You know, they can't really be intensively farmed. You can't remove the massive horns that they have. You can't remove them. And they're never going to be bred to, they will never produce the same quantities of milk as a Friesian. They can't, they produce about 20, up to 20 litres a day, 15 to 20 litres a day. But that's, they're perfect. That's the perfect place for them. And we then drove from Campania into Basilicata. And so many people don't know southern Italy, and I would encourage everybody to go on holiday there because it's so wild. You have lots of wonderful national parks, the Lucano, the Sila, the Pollino, and they're really wild and really beautiful. And they're mountainous, and so they're not, you can't have buffalo there, but then they are replaced by sheep, goats, and then the famous cheese making cow of the south is the Podolica cow. I don't know if you've ever
seen it. I've never heard of it, no. Tell me about it.
Okay, it's they're beautiful grey, big grey cattle, and they were widespread across Italy, and then in kind of the 19th century they started to breed. They imported cattle from elsewhere. They bred the breeds that we know the names of nowadays, so the Chianina, the Romagnola, the Marchigiana. But then in the south, in the lost, forgotten south, the Podolica remained, and it's the perfect cow for those wild mountain areas. And it's really, they've done a lot of research, and in fact, genetically, it is actually linked. It has links to the auroch.
Wow. I saw they had a Stonehenge exhibition, British Museum, and I saw an auroch skull, which was just with these incredible horns and this most amazing, powerful shape, really. Wow. That's fascinating. Yeah. So these are hardy enough then to, they can cope with mountains then, can they, with this hilly terrain?
They can cope with them. Yeah, they are. So they're in the south, your pasture is sparse, water is scarce, survival is really difficult, but they can survive it. And so, and they traditionally have been reared there together with sheep. So you will have these farms. Podolica are brilliant because they can keep down the vegetation that allows sheep to graze as well. So farmers will have a herd of Podolica and then a herd of sheep making Pecorino, and the Podolica, who produce amazing milk, again, high in fat and protein, but they have a very low yield. But they are, their cheese then, the famous cheese from the south of Italy, is Caciocavallo. And that is they're all linked. So on the in Campania, in the plain by the coast, you have the fresh mozzarella. But then as you go into the mountains where you need to preserve cheese, you have Caciocavallo, Provola, Scamorza. So they are all this same style of stretched cheese, but that they'll be more or less aged then.
What to give them so they got a longer, so they'll keep for longer. Better then. Tell us a little bit about stretch curd, because you just touched on it there, which is a very specific sort of family of cheese, isn't it? So could you just tell us a little bit about how that family, what does that term mean?
I think, again, kind of geographically, you needed to have, because you had lot of these mountains, so you've had a long, long history of transhumance. So moving cattle and sheep seasonally from high pastures in the mountains to lower down. When it gets too cold in the winter, they'd have to go further down to warmer pastures. And so you stretch curds, cheeses came about. The thing about a stretch curd cheese is you need a lot of skill to make them, but you don't need any equipment. So to make the curds are, you cut the curds as you do with regular cheese, but then you leave them a little while to develop a bit of acidity. You bathe them in hot water, and that makes them elastic, and you can stretch them. So they use these amazing wooden sticks to stretch the curd just at the right time. It can't be done too soon, or the cheeses will be too mushy. And if you leave the curds too long, then the cheeses will be hard and dry. But these long, shiny fibers of curd are formed and then kneaded into balls of cheese, and they can be any shape. But then once they have been made, you can have them. Traditionally, Caciocavallo is a round cheese with this little head at the top, around which you tie a string, and then you can hang them up in pairs along a pole to age. And those pairs of cheese, the word Caciocavallo literally means horse cheese, and so you could string them over a horse. They can travel with the shepherds or the people who are making the transhumance. They were very simple cheeses, but they are the perfect for that.
Yes, portable cheeses, and you're using the milk. Yeah, brilliant.
Yeah.
And that's such a vivid, that's a wonderful image. Yes, and that very distinctive shape that Caciocavallo has. Fascinating. Yeah. So that's so interesting. So, yes, so I'm getting a real sense of place and cheese. Very tied in, then, the geography and shaping the animals. And this is always the issue, obviously, that, you know, cheese is made from milk. Milk comes from livestock. What type of livestock does where you are allow you to have, or what's best suited to where you are, I suppose? That's always going to be a factor, isn't it?
I mean, they don't, obviously, tradition is, things don't change fast in Italy. And so even though now, we were visiting dairies, and they didn't all have Podolica cows, that they are increasingly rare, but still the tradition hasn't changed. In the north in Emilia, in Parmesan country, you've got these incredible 40 kilo wheels of cheese, but that has, in the south, you still, even if you are, have got a higher milk yield from these more modern cows that are increasingly raised down in the south, still Caciocavallo, these small, they never weigh more than a couple of kilos, really. That there is no tradition of producing these massive cheese like they do further north. And indeed, heading further, so we have a supplier in Sicily. Sicily is perhaps even more wild. There they make a provola. We import a provola dei Nebrodi, and the Nebrodi Mountains, where you also have the amazing black pig, the Nera dei Nebrodi, but you have these incredible mountain cows in Sicily. They are not a particular breed. They're really small. They're so small and wiry, and they survive incredibly harsh conditions. And yeah, it's a similar thing. So it's even more harsh, the conditions in Sicily. And so you, as you get further south, it's just a world away from when you fly into, you come to Parma, and then you have these incredible dairies making wheels of Parmesan cheese that have come about because you're on this big plain of the River Po that has led to industrial farming and agriculture and very different styles of cheese making.
That must be very, yes, that really comes across. And I mean, it is fascinating, isn't it? I mean, every time I get it, really, the depth of the originality, it always surprises me, you know. And just, you can just travel not for, you know, you can spend an hour on a train and you'll hit a very different food place, you know, and that sense of place. And that must be, you must really enjoy it. That must be one of the perks of your job, Alison, that this travelling around and that excitement of perhaps, you know, perhaps going to see, you know, someone who's been recommended to you whom you don't know, or, you know, and making your way up to find someone. There must be all sorts of fascinating encounters when you do something like that.
Oh, well, yeah, we're very, it's a lovely job. We are very lucky, and obviously we get to eat fantastic food, and we had it's always interesting actually to eat with these people as well, because they are introducing us to their products through their traditional local recipes. So we had last week, we had it's autumn, and so there are pumpkins wherever you look in Italy. So we had fabulous pumpkin that was sweet and kind of in agrodolce, so slightly pickled with a bit of sugar.
Sour sweet.
With mozzarella and beautiful grilled scamorza cheeses. So the slightly more aged stretched curd cheese that is grilled and served with wild bitter greens, and beautiful, very autumnal. But they use these different cheeses in different ways, and all of them are very delicious.
Wonderful. Well, Alison, thank you so much. That was a very transporting interview that's made me long to go back to Italy. So thank you.
Thanks very much. Bye.
I'm a huge fan of Peter's Yard's crackers, and they always feature on my Christmas cheese board. All Peter's Yard's crackers are made in small batches, using quality natural ingredients and their sourdough starter, slowly fermented for 16 hours for award-winning flavour and crunch. Visit petersyard.com/shop, enter the code SLICEOFCHEESE at the checkout to receive 25% off your first order.
Online, on smart speakers and on Listen Again, this is Food FM.
Enhance your cheese board with Peter's Yard sourdough crackers this Christmas. Available at Waitrose, Sainsbury's, Morrison's, Ocado, Amazon, petersyard.com and specialist food retailers.
Before we go on exploring the world of cheese, here's news of another Food FM programme that I think you'd really enjoy.
Thank you, Jenny. Well, I'm David, the host of The Drinking Hour here on Food FM. Each week we explore the wonderful world of wine, spirits and beer, all things that make wonderful pairings with cheese, of course. We hear from those for whom making drinks is a passion. So after your cheese course, how about you join me for a few drinks? You can find The Drinking Hour with David Kermode on your usual podcast platform and at foodfmradio.com. Now it's back to Jenny and a slice of cheese.
For this episode of A Slice of Cheese, I'm exploring the idea of the geography of cheese, how place informs and helps make the cheeses that we enjoy. I'm very happy to have with me today the cheesemonger Andy Swinsko from the Courtyard Dairy in Yorkshire. Hello, Andy.
Hi, Jenny.
Andy, this is a subject I guess you're pretty really interested in. I wanted to talk to you in a way about British geography and, of course, the climate that is, it goes with where we are and how it's shaped the cheeses that we eat in Britain. I was really interested to get your thoughts on that. Is that something that you've thought about?
Yeah. It's something I love, how geography then ties into social history and market, and everything kind of ties together really nice and neatly. And that's fundamentally why we get different cheeses. I mean, I know we're looking, but, you know, the north of Europe makes these temperate cheeses that the classic cheese board cheeses, because of we have that climate to mature them in thick stone wall barns throughout the summer when it's still quite hot, and we have those caves. You know, whereas Greece is so hot that they didn't, so that they pickled it in salt, and that's the way it lasted, and that's why you get feta. You know, in Mongolia, they spread it on the top of their shacks, and they make, like, this jerky-type cheese so that they can carry it around because they're nomadic. And then, like, in India, they developed ghee as their method of preserving milk. So the way we get because it's so hot, they couldn't make these cheeses that we make over here. They couldn't mature them. So I find it fascinating how every culture finds its way of preserving milk. And then even within Britain itself, we find different ways because of geography, climate, how far we are away from market, et cetera, et cetera.
And what if you think of the sort of historic British cheese scene? Are there cheese, you know, and we often, in fact, we use that phrase territorial, don't we? That is used to describe a whole family of British cheeses. And as the word suggests, it's to do with sort of territories that were known for cheeses. So these are cheeses like Cheshire and Lancashire and Wensleydale. Well, tell us about those cheeses, Andy.
Yeah, I think it's fascinating how they come about because of where they are in the world and why we get those cheeses, but then how fast they develop. So, I mean, the majority of British cheese is made on the west side of the country, which I'm sure you know, because that is it's plentiful land for grass because we get it's wet, lots of growths of grass from that sea air blowing the rain. It's kind of rolling, so it's perfect for keeping cows. So again, when you look at geography, you're constrained. If you wanted to farm in that old-fashioned way, when cows were out of pasture, the way that they did it in the olden days, it was the only way. You're constrained by how far your cows can walk to milk them every day, really. And so areas like Cheddar and Cheshire is kind of plentiful lands, flat and rolling. So one milking parlour can sustain a lot more cows because the cows don't have to walk that far. So as a result, more cows, bigger cheeses, you know, that then last longer, that can then go into cities and transport better. Whereas you come up to the Yorkshire Dales, it's a lot more challenging. You know, it's a lot more steeper. So we still had some dairying of cows, but at the same time, one milking parlour was supporting probably only 20, 30 cows historically. So as a result, much less milk, much smaller cheeses, didn't really transport out the region as well, didn't keep as well. And then you get a similar thing in Lancashire, and that's why Lancashire, creamy Lancashire, has a completely different recipe. So in Wensleydale, we just made smaller cheeses. But in Lancashire, their farms were so small that they bulked up the curd over several days because milk goes off before refrigeration, but curd doesn't. Yeah. So they would make a bit of curd, but it was too much effort to finish the cheese, and it would make too small a cheese. So only start the process. But after 3 days of starting the process, they'd have enough bits together to make one big cheese. Right. And that's what developed creamy Lancashire. And so you see these cheeses develop over time and then continue to evolve because of the land and what can grow underneath and also how many cows they can keep and how much rain they get. And it's just all so intertwined. And again, how far they are away from market. You know, you're miles away from market, you're going to make a harder, drier cheese. Traditionally in Yorkshire, we did make soft cheeses, but they were around York, and Nottingham did, and they were around Nottingham because they're close to cities. So they made these soft cheeses because they could transport them fast into cities.
Before they perished, That's such a good point, isn't it? And I presume, I mean, and if you think of Cheshire cheese and how that was the cheese of the British Navy, and, you know, and it was, you know, it journeyed around the world, didn't it, as a food. And that's another interesting way of thinking about cheese in place, I suppose, is that but a hard, dry cheese with good keeping qualities becomes this very important journey food in a way, doesn't it?
Yeah, and I think Cheshire cheese is a brilliant one to look at because Cheshire went as kind of Britain's original cheese. Cheshire went as kind of Britain's original cheese that kind of ended up in, you know, it's London's fine artisan, the best cheese it could be get. Something was as good as Cheshire, then that was the bee's knees, you know. And then, but because that was... Because of where they are, it's a land of plenty, Cheshire. You know, it's flat. They get everything in Cheshire. It's you know, if you want to farm, you want to farm in that kind of Cheshire, Shropshire area, you know. And so because of that, they had these big cows. They made these big hard cheeses, which were very successful. But it also meant that when cheesemaking started to improve, areas like that and then down into the Cheddar region improved much faster because they had bigger farms and more cheese being made. That was where the, you know, the scientists and the dairy technologies concentrated on. So actually their recipes evolved faster, you know. So
that's interesting.
Cheshire started using bacteria and more heat in production earlier than anywhere else and became more efficient earlier than anywhere else because obviously that when they were so big, they were the first ones to advance. Whereas by the time that knowledge got up to Wensleydale, you know, it was much longer and slower and the farms went bigger. And so they didn't evolve quite as fast and quite as aggressively initially. And so it's really interesting. Not only is it where you are in the world and how far away from market, but also that size of farm because of the plentiful land then ties into, you know, how fast they advance because then industrialization concentrates on those bigger dairy producing areas, doesn't it? So that evolves the Cheshire recipe faster than perhaps Wensdale.
That's fascinating, isn't it? So it's a very good point.
And it's really interesting that you still find that everywhere in Britain, kind of that west side from Lancashire down to Cheddar, they all use the same terminology in cheesemaking because they advanced fast and then the dairy technology spread up. Whereas you get up to Wensdale and they say things in different ways. You know, they call milling, grinding. They call, you know, they've got different phrases for the cheesemaking process. They don't seem to have caught on and they don't seem to use the same terminology that the rest of Britain uses. And I think that's because they stayed more remote and didn't advance quite as fast, and because the cheesemaking was much more small and a farm concern up until really the 50s.
And now there's quite a lot of, I mean, it's interesting how places used to sell, you know, to sell cheese as well. And so with cheddar, which is obviously Britain's most famous cheese, and we've got the Cheddar Gorges, and so now you can buy cheeses that are, you know, matured in the Cheddar Gorge, can't you? And there's a whole, an industry in a way of sort of linking, you know, and I suppose it's where you're getting that story across to the consumer, isn't it? Of that, there's this place called Cheddar, there's this cheese that, you know, was named after this place, came from this area, and you've got a link to it. And that's quite a potent sort of marketing tool, isn't it?
Yeah, I find it incredibly fascinating because obviously those cheeses developed in that region because of the geography, the climate, how far they were away from market. And that's why you got those styles of cheeses and what that cheese was going to be used for, whether it was traveling around the world or consumed locally. And then those cheeses then broadly became recipes, which then spread. And now, if you look at, I mean, I obviously have a bit of a focus towards the Dales where we are in Yorkshire. Mm. But up here, when you get more challenging environments, it's harder for one grass species to dominate. So we're very famous in the Dales for traditional hay meadows, Yorkshire Dales hay meadows. And that was because we're not flat and rolling and perfect. So no grass species can dominate. It's not easy to produce just that easy one simple type of grass. So that's why you got more diverse flora and fauna historically in those traditional hay meadows in Yorkshire Dales, which still exist and are protected. Not all of them, unfortunately, but more and more. And as a result, that came through on the cheese. But then the cheese, you know, cheeses then become recipes and they become styles and you lose that nature. So we try and work with our farmers, like Stonebeck, for example, to try and capture that fallen fauna and capture the way it was. And I find it very interesting. It's probably a whole chat for another episode on how we put the emphasis on place. So, for example, we put the emphasis on cheddar as the place where cheddar was from. And that was historically because of the climate and because of the location and because of the geography and because of the farming methods. But actually, those farming methods nowadays, you could argue, are almost exactly the same as Cheshire and Lancashire. And the cheesemaking methods, because they've industrialised and changed, are almost exactly the same. So actually, that's why they became recipes, is it became much more about equipment and farming became much more conventional. Everybody farms the same breed of cows, same breed of grass, you know. And there's differences in rainfall and subsoils. But actually, when you look at a field between the two counties now, those differences have become much more died out and everywhere seems to be fairly conventional. And it's interesting how the next stage for artisan British cheese for me is to kind of look at that. What is terroir? I know we're just saying it's from there because it's from the region. Are you buying lots of food and fairly generic cow breed? Is it just because it's made in the right town? You know, and that's a real big debate we have in our shop, is how do you define a cheese from the place? Because you can make a cheese in a place, but you can keep your cows indoors and you can bring all the feed to them, you know? So, and it can be feed, you know, so why?
It can be quite artificial. I mean, that's right. And it has to be meaningful, doesn't it?
It doesn't.
It can be a very nice label, can't it?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, sorry, I've gone off on a tangent.
No, I love rants. Yes.
You know,
no,
I'm not meaning to, pick on any type of place, but where do we define history? Where do we define the place? You know, it's a very interesting topic of discussion. But historically, geography was that key to that. And that's why those cheeses developed in those regions. And then people will use them as marketing tools to this day. But you could argue that's kind of not.
Well, in fact, you mentioned Stainbeck. I mean, I think what's really interesting, Andy, is that, and again, it's, you know, if you think of what happened when you opened your shop in the sort of, you know, if I'm without being rude, I hope, in the middle of nowhere, in a way, not an obvious place for a, you know, for a fine cheese shop to exist, and you have made this market, and then this wonderful thing that around you now are raw milk cheese makers, because, and the reason they're there is because you're there. You know, what's really fascinating is you've, you know, it's a lovely sort of symbiosis between the fact that if you have a shop that's championing farmhouse cheeses and has found an audience for them, then cheesemakers on farms can think, oh, you know, there's this shop that I can sell my cheese to, and a local shop as well. That's pretty exciting, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it's great. Great little, when you get good businesses, they incubate each other, don't they? And yeah, I think that's exactly. That's really key to, you see it, not just us, but in other areas and other cheese shops. You see it in like Borough Market, really, what Neil's Yard Dairy has done there, and then again in the Arches. And, you know, you kind of see it here, hopefully. You know, one of the things I'm most proud of is that, you know, when we set up, there was no farmhouse producer of Dale's cheese making with raw milk in Yorkshire. You know, Yorkshire's got 5 million people. And Wensleydale cheese is as historic as everything. And yes. Obviously the creamy, the factory made a fabulous example of that. But, you know, there was no... We made farmhouse Wensleydale for over 1,000 years and that died out. And now we have three back, which is great. And I think that's a success story that we would hopefully like to see repeated in other regions with other cheese shops. And I think, you know, and the great thing is somebody like Stonebeck is really capturing the real nature of old-fashioned breeds of cows, traditional hay meadows, and really showing what that cheese was. And I think that, for me, is a really special thing.
Well, in fact, that's what's interesting, you know, that you said, because you work closely with these local cheesemakers and you must get to taste the cheese at different times of the year, do you get that real sense and feel of how what the animals are eating changes the cheese? You actually get to experience that then, do you?
Yeah, I think that's what, yeah. Again, if you're farming like something like Stonebeck with the cows, they only make through the spring and the summer when the cows are out of pasture. And feed very little else. So you really get a reflection, in which case, of what the cows are eating. And, you know, we see that seasonal changes within the cheese, hugely within that cheese. And that's really exciting. I think it's something to be kind of, you know, excited about and see as it goes through the seasons. And again, it provides challenges because the cheese is slightly more variable than if you're standardizing consistent milk and from animals that are fairly fed on a consistent diet. But is at the same time also exciting from a cheesemonger's point of view, providing you can talk to the customers about those changes.
Yeah, that's really interesting, isn't it? That sort of the role. I mean, it's interesting if you think of a cheese like Caerphilly, you know, historic Welsh cheese, and yet, which has been, you know, the making of it has been industrialised. And then, so if you want to look for a farmhouse Caerphilly, you now really have to go to Somerset. But there was a long tradition of the cheddar makers in Somerset making Caerphilly as well, because it was a younger cheese that could be sold quicker and there was a big market for Caerphilly. So that tradition, you know, it transplanted itself in a way to a different bit of Britain, which is so complex, isn't it, when you start thinking about it?
Yeah, exactly. It's really interesting how it all, the history of food is so interconnected with what the people could grow and eat and farm traditionally, and then how it evolves from there and how much rain you had, what grasses would grow. And now it's become fairly conventional, but there's still, you know, big regional variances. You know, most of the farms on here still have 60 cows, which is small by Britain's standards. And that's because of where we are in the world, even the conventional farming techniques. So they still get those regional variances creeping in, definitely.
And it's something that you obviously enjoy showcasing in your shop, Andy, then?
Oh, yeah, I think that, geography's key to the flavour, you know, and I think there's a reason I like to buy Red Leicester from Sparkenhole Farm. You know, there's a reason I like to buy Stitchelton from Joe Schneider down in Nottinghamshire, you know, because I think that it's, if you can tie all those dots together, it really, you get the sense of place as well, you know, and that you know, and those cheeses have developed for a reason. That's the other thing, whilst we're talking about geography, is also how it ties into market, you know. The fact that Stilton became famous was because of the geography of where it was sold. You know, yeah. if they hadn't stopped on those coaching inns at the Bell Inn, you know, because of the geography of and the way we were transporting people, then nobody would have eaten Stilton, and it might have been as famous as Dorset Blue Vinny, you know, which was made at the same time. You know, in terms of fame, one of them is worldwide renowned, and one of them's pretty much, well, it has one producer kind of making little bits and pieces.
Yes.
And
that's so interesting.
Geography ties into also those transport routes. And that's because nobody was, no offence to Dorset, but nobody was transporting through Dorset. You know, and so Stilton's fame is reliant upon where, you know, how easy it was connected to that people staying coming from London. You know, and I think geography, it's all so interconnected. It's fascinating when you start to stretch away.
Well, it's very multifaceted, isn't it? Indeed. Mm. Brilliant. Oh, thank you, Andy. That's a wonderful insight. Thank you for your time. Great to talk to you. Thank you, Andy.
My pleasure.
To find out more about Food FM and our content, go to foodfmradio.com.
Enhance your cheese board with Peter's Yard sourdough crackers this Christmas. Available at Waitrose, Sainsbury's, Morrison's, Ocado, Amazon, petersyard.com, and specialist food retailers.
Thank you so much for listening to A Slice of Cheese. I hope you've enjoyed it. If you have enjoyed it, it would be lovely if you could rate us on wherever you've found this podcast. It will make such a difference to us. So I hope you'll enjoy us again. Thank you very much.